The recordings have now started. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Natalie. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. On today's PPSC PDP call, August 6th, we have Jeff Newman, Sophia Bekele, James Bladel, Tatiana Kramsova, Avery Doria, Paul Diaz, Alan Greenberg. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Ken Bauer, Glenda Saint-Géry, Gisela Gruber-White, myself, and as apologies, we have Gabriel Pinheiro, Liz Gaster, Marilyn Cade. Can I also please just remind everyone, when you do speak, please just state your names for transcription purposes and for the recording purposes. Much appreciated. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Gisela, I see that David Maher has just joined as well.
David Maher has just joined as well, yes.
Thank you.
Right. Hey, David.
Hi.
Good morning, afternoon, everyone. This is the August 6th call of the PDP work team of the PPSC. Just to go over the role again, I just want to clarify that we do not have anyone from the ISPs, the IP constituency, the business constituency, or the non-commercial constituency. Is that right? Okay, just double checking. On that note, you know, like attendance has been really low these last, well, frankly, since even before Sydney, it's been pretty low in this work team. I did send a note last week to the chairs of each of the constituencies and to the NOMCOM appointees to the council to indicate exactly who has been showing up and who has not been showing up. I have not gotten a response from any of the constituencies, although James has informed me that the registrars have received it and discussed it, although I will note for the record that the registrars actually probably have the best attendance of any of the constituencies on these calls, since one of them is always on these calls, if not two of the three reps that have been indicated for this group. Has anyone, well, I guess I'm asking the people who actually do show up, and I know that you know, David has also shown up for the registries for most of the calls as well. So the people who haven't shown up are the people that are still not on this call. So I was going to ask the question if any of those constituencies have received the notice, but I guess they're not here to ask that question. Avery, is this something that you might want to show the council or have a discussion about? Or
certainly. I mean, I've brought up, you know, in different contexts, attendance at things. And in addition to the workload and the fact that people haven't really stretched out within their constituencies yet as far as they can, we also have the issue that it is August and people. But I certainly will bring it up again, and if you want the, you know, to put the attendance list on record earlier than when a report is filed, sure, you know, feel free. Or have, you know, someone on the council list send it to the council, or I'll even post it for you if you wish. And I'll certainly keep bringing it up, but I don't know of any way to do more than encourage people. And at least this time, I won't have to claim. And in fact, last time, I think you asked the same of me or two meetings ago, and I did bring it up, admitted my hypocrisy, but brought it up and encouraged people. And then when I saw your attendance list, I felt guilty and made sure I showed up.
Thanks, Aubrey. Yeah, I, on that attendance list, I actually went back to March just because I knew, you know, obviously August is usually a slow month, but if you look at the pattern, I don't think there's much of a difference between April and August, although today's is particularly low. But in general, from the last meeting on, I think it's been a pretty consistent low attendance record. And, I mean, we're going to continue to do the work. It's just, and we're going to continue to make progress. It just would be nice to get other viewpoints, and I'm afraid that once we come out with our report, then we're going to start to hear from all of the people that haven't been participating, and you know, I don't want that to slow things down. I know that, for example, I know that the commercial stakeholder group, and so that includes the BC, the ISP, and the IP constituency have made arguments saying that, you know, they need more time to consider these issues. They're not having people show up at all. So anyway, with that under our belt, we've asked Ken Bauer to come on to help explain some of the changes, at least to the bylaws, at least mostly with one concern. Appendix A.
Jeff, you're breaking up an awful lot.
Really? Let me try getting on my headset. That might work better.
Is this any better?
So far.
No.
So far? Okay. That works better. We've just went to new IP phone system, and sometimes it breaks up. So I've said we've asked Ken Bauer to come on the call today to go through the changes that were just posted earlier this week, I believe, to the bylaws, especially particularly for this group with relation to Appendix A, although I think Ken will cover kind of the changes throughout the entire document. And I know Avery had a question about a threshold that was removed. So why don't I turn it over to Ken, and then we could take questions to Ken or anyone on ICANN policy staff.
Thank you, Jeff. Ken Bauer here. I'm actually sitting in for Margie, who would also wanted to be here, but I think she's actually traveling, and she asked me if I would cover it. So I've been working closely with Margie on the bylaws for many months now. although she's the expert on Annex A, I think I can probably cover most of it. What I'd like to do is to start, if we could, with, let me just make this a comment. This is the second round of bylaws amendments that have been posted. We just completed one on the 29th of July, as I recall, and that was largely the changes that were initially created by staff, and then the GNSO Council drafting team did an extensive amount of work on the language. And that all of that, in addition to a few other staff comments or changes that were recommended, that became the substance of version 1 or V1. Then sort of during and after Sydney, there were a number of other sort of issues that came up. And we decided that just because there were so many sort of nuances and changes and some things that legal had recommended, that we would go back out again for another public comment on bylaws, which we're calling V2. Jeff has asked already about the short time frame, and indeed, as you suggested, we had to tie this thing up quickly because the board meeting is the 27th of August, and what we thought we could squeeze a public comment period in, recognizing there's already been one, and we've tried as hard as we could to document, and I'll cover some of this, what was changed, where it was changed, show the old language, the new language, and everything else to try to facilitate that process, recognizing, though, that we are in August, and everybody sort of knows that. It's just not good timing. The idea, though, is that we want to get the council, the new council, seated in Seoul. The general take among those of us that work on this is that we need to have those bylaws approved on the 27th of August. There has been some discussion. I'm not even sure. There are some possibilities, even if we don't go for board approval, we might go for, like, board approval in principle. Which would be something along the lines that if there are some issues on the bylaws that haven't been tied down or something needs to be addressed a little bit later than 27 August, maybe there could be a motion that says the council is to operate, these bylaws are to be used in principle, and we'll just tie up loose ends thereafter. Something along that line is also being discussed on the legal team. Any questions about about that? Because what I'd like to do then is just to talk a little bit about what it is we put out there for public comment, and then let me pause. Okay, great. The first document I'd like to talk about is this one that's up on the Adobe Connect. It's called a sort of complete side-by-side comparison document. Some of the sections in here, not too many, will appear new to the GNSO Council drafting team, like Section 7 that deals with nominating committee. We had written those changes months and months ago. We just didn't share all that with the Council because the feeling at that point was we just needed to focus on Article 10. But in this case, what we wanted to do for this public comment was to put everything out on the table so everybody can see all the changes. There are no other bylaws changes related to GNSO restructuring that are not in this document that we know of at the moment, unless somebody goes and finds one.
This is Aubrey. Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
If these changes have all been ready that long, why weren't they put in last month's comment call?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a really good answer for you. It wasn't anything strategic. I think the idea was to get the material that the council had done out for public comment. Yeah, it could have been included in that one, but, none of the changes to Annex A were done then. Just really, we're only talking about this Article 7, to be honest. That's the only one I think that's actually, it wasn't in there. And we could actually look at it if you want. It's pretty straightforward. And even as we sit here, we're communicating with the SIC, the Structural Improvements Committee, to work with the Nominating Committee to even make some additional changes potentially to the way the Nominating Committee would be populated. So that's still a bit of work in progress and could end up changing between now and the 24th of August when this closes. Anything that is recommended will get posted in the public comments so you'll be able to see it. Basically, the only change we made here to this section in Section 2 of Article 7 was to just make a name change. So Registry Stakeholder Group and Registrar Stakeholder Group. Everything else was pretty much kept the same. I don't think we need to sort of go through all the articles or all the sections in Article 10 with respect to the PDP team. But I think there's a couple that I wanted to point out, and I'm going to just scroll down here I want to get to Section 3, 4. Okay. This is another one that I'm not sure this was actually that the council saw this originally. We didn't think there needed to be any change to this particular paragraph in Section 3. Essentially, what it deals with is the GNSO operating procedures, which is another separate document. The bylaws originally, and we'll see this in a second when we scroll down, contained a lot of detail about absentee voting and quorums and vacancies and a lot of sort of administrative detail that a lot of us felt shouldn't be at the level of bylaws. It should be in council operating rules that are is an additional document. And so after some discussion with legal, Margie and a bunch of us sort of rewrote this Section 4, and Jeff has made an email comment on this one as well. But in essence, the idea here was to give the council some flexibility so that it could change its rules, approve them as a council, put them out for 20-day public comment period, and the board's role would be oversight and review, not necessarily approval. And the reason that was done was to not to put the board in the critical path, so that the council could make some changes and implement things it might need for bicameral voting that were missed or something like that, and get them done quickly, get them approved, and operate, and then the board would review, and if it didn't like what it saw, it could certainly ask that it be changed.
Yes, so if I can interrupt, so my comment was on that I filed by email, was you're making a presumption even before the public comment period that the rules you establish are going to be valid, and there's no check and balance, and frankly, no reason for a public comment period, because if after that expiration period it's presumed to be valid and it goes into effect, that first of all, it's going to take the board a while to act, so you're going to have the rule in effect for a certain period of time before the board could even act. And then the question is whether oversight really means the right to unilaterally not approve of a change. I mean, you get into this whole debate as to what oversight actually means. And I just think you're basically admitting in the bylaws that a public comment period on these rules of operation is meaningless. There's no, why even have a public comment period? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think I understand your point, and you've made it articulately in the email, I think. So this one, I think, should just go back to the legal team that's working on these and decide if that, and maybe we'll see some additional public comments on it as well.
Right.
I just tell you that what the intent when it was written was we wanted to take the board out of the sort of the approval of rules and procedures that a council should be able to do on its own if it can achieve a majority vote among the two houses, right? and so that was the idea.
Well, I mean, part of my hesitancy on this is because I'm not sure where the line is drawn between what is an operating procedure and what's in a bylaw. And until I see that definitive line, or until I see exactly a definition of what needs to be in the operating, what needs to be in the bylaws versus what needs to be in the operating procedures, I'm not comfortable with, you know, personally, I'm not comfortable with any of this. I'm certainly not comfortable with setting a blanket rule that anything in the operating procedures can be approved by the council, and no role for the ICANN board on it, especially given, you know, the registries and registrars are bound by consensus policies, and what may be considered by some as just a change to an operating procedure could be interpreted by others as having a significant effect on the consensus policy process.
This is Aubrey. Can I get in the queue?
Sure.
Aubrey, Alan, anyone else? Okay, Aubrey.
Okay, on a couple things. I think that it would be relatively easy for it to be changed so that it was a two-step, and this is only answering one of your issues. It was a two-step for the approval by council, and that is one that the council would say send this and decide that it was complete and it was to be sent out to public comment, and then that it had a review period where it had to respond to the public comment, and then it could vote. So using something very similar to the PDP comment period, it could certainly be done, and that would answer the question of, you know, somehow training ourselves to actually listen to people's comments and not, you know, throw them away as we so often do. The other part of where is the line strictly dividing what is and what isn't, I would think that is something that, A, would come out in those discussions. I don't think it'll be possible for people to give an explicit definition, you know, of all the places and all the things that may or may not have a consensus policy effect. I think everyone accepts that consensus policy effect, no, it's a bylaws issue, and not otherwise isn't, and you're right, interpretations make the border fuzzy. But I do think that, you know, we have that bit of knowledge. The fact that there would be board oversight to look at it and say, no, this one should be bylaws and roll it back. They would know what was going on, one would hope, as this was going on, because they would see the public comment period. And so in those cases where they thought there was a problem and something for exception-based oversight to take care of, they would know that they had to get themselves in gear, and we could hope that they would learn to do that. So I guess I don't see the same problem as you do in the second instance, and in the first instance, the solution is relatively simple.
Okay, Alan?
Yeah, I basically support what Jeff said and the first part of what Avery said. First of all, on a nit, or perhaps not a nit, the words used there are approved by a majority vote of each house. I think the wording we've been using in general is of both houses if both need changes. Otherwise, it's sort of confusing. On the specifics of board oversight and when it's needed, up until now in the last number of months in this group and I think in council in general, we have been using an expression which went something like, it doesn't really matter if it's in the rules or in the bylaws because the board has to approve everything anyway. So up until now, the decision made of where things go was without regard to board approval because it was assumed it was going to happen, with the exception of things in consensus policies which point to directly to the words bylaws. So I think we're going to have to be careful and go back and make sure that we didn't push something into the rules on the understanding that it was okay because the board would approve it would have to approve it anyway in light of this new change.
Thanks, Alan. I think I agree with that point. I think that's a good one, and I'm not sure how we retrench and go back as part of, well, it's more for the restructuring group, I guess, to go back and figure that one out. Does anybody else have any comments on this particular issue?
This is Ken. I just want to comment that the language of each house has been that's the language legal wants.
Okay.
I wrote it as both houses every time, all the way in the beginning, and all of them got changed to each house. So that must be more precise.
Okay. Ken, if you want to continue on.
Sure. Okay. Good. We'll slide past four, and then if we go down to, you'll see, starting with eight, this is the stuff. Again, I agree, we won't be able probably to create any kind of definition about what is bylaws and what is, it's sort of an art than it is a science, but certainly by looking at the stuff that we're recommending come out of the bylaws, you can get an idea of the kind of thing we're talking about. So all these sections here that were actually duplicated in the council rules before are being recommended for coming out of the bylaws. And so they deal with things like this first paragraph has to do with, you can have a meeting by electric video screen communications and, you know, that kind of stuff, operating details. There's some absentee voting issues, what is a quorum, that kind of thing. We think that all of those things should end up being in the council rules.
Mr. Robert, can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
The absentee ballot is directly, in fact, the clause of absentee ballot, unless it's been changed, refers to it as being for initiation or of either a report or a PDP and elections. So in this case, using the does it have an effect on consensus policy, I would say that it seems to fall on the side of consensus policy since the clauses under which it's used pertain to PDPs.
I think that's a good point, Aubrey, and actually something that is one of our next topics on stage two, on our stage two document, in talking about the voting thresholds to initiate various parts of the PDP and what type of, what does that mean? Do the thresholds mean of the members present, or does it mean of the total members, and then you can allow absentee voting? But so I think that's a good point.
Okay, so all this material has been sort of marked anyway, temporarily, until it's approved for deletion. I'm going to go ahead at this point and skip. I think the rest of this all deals with material. There were some word changes to much of what the council did, but a lot of it is not substantive. There's another document that I'll talk about in a minute, in which goes through every single section and every paragraph and basically crisply says what was different between version 1 and version 2. We can take a look at that document also. But the idea was to give a mapping from one version to the next. There's also a third document that was posted that's a sort of a staff rationale document on some of the key changes. Not all, but just some of the key changes. Let's see. So at this point, I think probably what we could do is just sort of go all the way down to Annex A. And this is where I suspect you'll... the reason I brought those other sections up is for precisely the reason that we've already talked about. What is and isn't is in the bylaws and what's not may turn out to have an implication as to Annex A. Oh, I'm sorry, I've gone too far. Okay. So So what we've done is we've taken each section of Annex A, I think there are 16 of them, and basically done the same thing. We put the old bylaws language on the left. We show the strikeout, any changes in color, and the right is the should be the clean way it would read if ultimately approved. I don't imagine that, Jeff, you want to go through these one at a time with me. I'm not sure how you want to go through it, but as we scroll through, was that we didn't make any changes to Section 2, for example. And then in Section 3, you can see that there was a change to Clause or Subparagraph C.
I think the ones that we want to go over are probably ones not where you just change constituency to stakeholder group, but probably the ones that where you make some additional wording changes.
Right. And so the general idea, we initially, when we first wanted to make all these bylaws changes for the GNSO Council restructuring, it was the idea we were working on is we didn't want to do anything to Annex A. We wanted to deal with all of the sort of threshold issues and voting and stuff just in the transition article, Article 20, and essentially say, look, until Annex A is revised, we use the following information to construct bicameral voting, and then later on, because there's a lot that in Annex A that needs to be revised, as you guys well know. But legal did not like that at all. They did not want one section of the bylaws to say one thing and another section to say something else, and so Margie took the task to try to go through here, and legal has been over it twice now also to try to make it as consistent as possible going forward. And if we miss something, you know, we certainly would like to have it pointed out.
It's out here. So essentially what you're looking for is us to look at it and make sure or give you our opinion that what you've changed is both necessary and consistent with what we think the new PD, the new threshold or other rules are, and to look for anything that may have been omitted.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, let me slide back up here to Section 311, I think it is, because 311 is where we have the thresholds. There's a default threshold that at the top that basically says a simple majority in each house is sort of the default condition. then you see the create issues report, initiate a PDP, and all that, and those thresholds. What Margie tried to do was to make sure that what's in Annex A is consistent with A through F here. This might be a good time also to answer Avery's question about what happened to the chair threshold. You'll see that was taken out. And again, there's a somewhere up in here there is a paragraph that says the election of chair is a GNSO operating principle matter. I believe it's right here. The procedures for selecting the chair and any other officers are contained in the GNSO operating procedures. And so if there's the 60% of each house rule, which was something that came out of the working group on GNSO council restructuring, that's what the work team will be writing into the draft operating procedures for election of chair.
This is Aubrey. Can I ask a question? So that means it hasn't been lost, it's just been moved?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Well, when you say moved, do we have a draft GNSO operating procedures document?
Yes. Well, it's in the process of being drafted now. There's a team. Julie Hedlund is sort of the head. Rob and Julie are working with the GNSO operations work team, I believe it's called, and they have the task. And there is actually a structure. There's actually a document that has chapter headings and topics. It was pulled over from the old one. It's been redlined and marked up, and there are sections in there that need to be drafted specifically before SOL so that the rules around quorum, like, for example, the quorum rule I think that we're looking at now is a quorum is a majority in each house. So that needs to get written in because today's quorum rules are not applicable. And so, and the same thing, you know, with absentee voting and abstentions and all that, they're going to write all that material.
Okay, that's different from the document that came out describing a whole separate administrative body.
Yes, that is different, correct.
Okay.
Okay, so...
So the comment, just I'll just reiterate the comment I made on email, too, which is Section 7D, which talks about, you know, this is if task forces are created. And when it goes to the public comment period, I think we might have gone...
Yeah, so if we go down to 7... When I scroll this, is everybody seeing it?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
7B, C, D.
Yeah, here we go.
I think it's just a typo that was done here. But basically, this is getting constituency and stakeholder group statements. It said at that point, if a supermajority vote, what it used to say is if a supermajority vote was reached, a clear statement of the constituency or position on the issue needed to be stated. Like every constituency statement should have it. For some reason, they inserted the words GNSO supermajority, which is not really applicable. What this paragraph is really trying to say is if the constituency, or in the future case, the stakeholder group, comes with the supermajority of that group, then a clear statement is required.
Okay.
If there's no supermajority of that stakeholder group, or constituency, presumably, then you're supposed to put in your statement all the positions espoused by the constituency stakeholder. It didn't mean GNSO supermajority.
Yeah, okay. That may very well be. That sounds right to me. I didn't do the editing on this document, so I'm not 100% sure. But we'll make sure that Margie and I and legal looks at that particular thing. You might be right.
Yeah, because at that point there would have been no vote by the GNSO council.
Right.
It doesn't make sense because there has not ever been a vote by the GNSO council on that. There's been no work product delivered by the group to the council, so there could be no vote.
Right.
It's Alan. However, if you replace GNSO with stakeholder group or constituency, what does that mean regarding stakeholder group? If you look at the stakeholder groups that are made up of multiple constituencies, is that requiring the stakeholder group to somehow assess the overall position of the stakeholder group, adding a significant level of overhead to the process? Or does it mean only if the stakeholder group happens to hold a vote, then it's relevant?
The way I interpret it is it would require the stakeholder group to assess supermajority if there's a supermajority of the entire stakeholder group, and if not, then to indicate all the positions of all the different constituencies within the stakeholder group.
Mrs. Avery, can I ask a question?
That sounds impossible under the current set of rules. But
yep. So let me put Avery and then Alan, if you want to respond to that.
Yeah, the question there is, for those stakeholder groups that are being forced to stay in the constituency model, you'd basically then be in a situation where you're asking for two things. One, a constituency statement from all the constituencies, and then somehow a stakeholder statement. And I think for those constituencies that have been forced for the stakeholder groups that have been forced to retain the constituency model, you know, you can't require it of the stakeholder group. You can only require it at the constituency level.
So just to respond to that, I think that's right. And look, in the end, we're the group that's charged with making recommendations to this section. I think what they're just trying to do, and Ken can jump in, is trying to have something that's there at the outset on this until we propose a new appendix and we could propose dealing with this differently. I don't think the board or anyone is empowered to make any other changes to this section other than the clarifying language.
That's right.
But what we're talking about right now is a very significant issue that must be addressed day one. The first time we call for what we're now calling constituency statements, what does the business, the commercial stakeholder group do with three constituencies within it? How do they weight each one of them? How do they somehow assess a supermajority?
It's not clear to me. This is Ken. I'm not interpreting that the stakeholder group has to do anything different. The original language just said if a supermajority vote was reached, a clear statement of the constituency's position. And all we did was add or stakeholder group. So it's still going to be the constituency's statement of position based on a supermajority. But if the constituency isn't there, in which case it's a stakeholder group. It's or. And so it's not. I don't think it's requiring the stakeholder groups to gather up and assess the constituency's position.
Okay, then I think it needs to make clear that for stakeholder groups that have constituencies, it is the constituency that's operative and not the stakeholder group in regard to this whole section.
Yeah, if you had seen, we actually had language like that. The constituency or stakeholder group without constituent, it gets really, really, really awkward language.
This is Aubrey. Can I comment?
Yeah.
I think that awkward language is indeed the price that has to be paid for basically having made a decision to have inconsistent rules between the two houses. And so I don't see any way that the bylaws can be legitimate if they don't take that awkward situation into account.
And then we could always, in our annex, say if this work team wants to make other recommendations, you know, it can do that. And I'm hoping, I would love for this group to actually have some definitive recommendations not long after the new structure goes into place.
Well, what we do in the long term is different. The question is what needs to be there for Seoul.
Right.
Sorry, if you could please just say your names for transcript purposes.
That was Alan, the last comment.
Thank you.
Okay, Ken, so that's been noted, and do you want to move on? Is there any other comments on that section? Nope. Okay, then let's...
Yeah, I don't know if we skipped around here or not. Again, the general idea was to simply recognize that we have stakeholder groups and constituencies now, and the rest of it was basically to incorporate the thresholds into the material, and that was pretty much it. We did, you know, there was. Do we even have task forces anymore?
We can. Hmm. In other words, until it's removed from the bylaws, I am forced. This is Aubrey speaking. Until it's removed from the bylaws, the way it's been written, I am forced as chair to always have a decision of some sort, a vote normally, although it often gets folded in with other votes, to decide whether there's a task force, because the bylaws are written. You do a PDP, you decide if there's a task force. If it's a committee of the whole, then the committee of the whole can figure out what you do. So everything we've been doing in terms of working groups have been a modality, a method used by committee of the whole, having decided not to do task force.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the way the bylaws are written, at post every decision to do a PDP, there needs to be a visible decision that a task force was not called for. So that has to be removed from the bylaws someday if we're not going to do that anymore. But until then, yeah, vote on it every time.
Okay.
Can you go back one to Section 11?
Sure.
It says there, and it says if a successful vote was not a successful GNSO vote. What does that mean?
All right. Let me take you down to the definitions in Section 16. A successful GNSO vote means an affirmative vote of the GNSO Council as determined in accordance with the bylaws, including without limitation a GNSO supermajority vote.
Okay, then if you go back up to that section, which is a board report, you're basically saying that a successful GNSO vote could be even a vote of a majority. And that has implications on a PDP.
Yeah, I'll have to defer to Margie on that.
Because I would not say, at least for a consensus policy process, if it's going to be imposed on the registries or registrars, a majority vote is not a successful GNSO vote for purposes of developing a consensus policy.
Well, it's successful, but it has a higher board threshold.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's successful. I just don't like the word successful. I think that's a kind of a connotation that is going to be very misleading to the public, because you can imagine articles coming out going, GNSO successfully approves whatever, and it didn't reach a threshold of a consensus policy.
But it is successful if the board doesn't reject it.
Yes.
It's just an easier threshold for them to reject.
No, I don't think so. If
yeah.
the board approves a GNSO recommendation, but it doesn't have a consensus, i.e. a supermajority of everyone else, then it cannot be imposed on the registries.
Mrs. Aubrey, can I comment?
Sure, yeah.
Certainly the rules we've been running under is that it is successful if it has a majority. It goes to the board differently, and the board has different treatment of it. And so there's basically successful and super successful if you really want to be. Super successful, super majority, means that the board can only overrule it by two-thirds vote of the board. If it's only successful, then the board needs to approve it. But in either case, it becomes consensus policy.
Yeah, it's Alan. If you state it all in positive ways, if GNSO has a supermajority, it only takes a third of the board to ratify it. If it is not a supermajority but a majority, then the board, and it requires a 50% plus vote of the board to ratify. Or maybe a supermajority of the board, I'm not sure.
And that's been the case in the bylaws.
I'm not sure that's true. Did Paul or James, David, is that the way you guys understand? I was always assuming that a two-thirds vote, you had to have a two-thirds vote, at least under the registrar agreements, you had to have a two-thirds vote of the council in order for it to ever become considered to be a consensus policy and binding on the registry. You could have a vote of the council majority and the board adopt that, but unless it had a supermajority of people underneath, it can't be imposed. So the board can adopt it as a best practice or a recommendation, but it cannot just impose that on the registries and registrars. That's not the way it works.
Yeah, this is Paul. That was my understanding, Jeff. I thought it was two-thirds to make it binding.
Yeah, let me. This is Ken. I'm going to hop back into this because there was something I did want to cover, and I kind of didn't check my notes carefully. If going back to Section 3 of Article 10, and I'm in Paragraph 11, I want to draw your attention to a new threshold that just got added in this. This is one of the key changes that came out. There were folks like Margie and some others were working on the RAA. Documents, and it was noticed that there is a provision that was just mentioned here on our call, that it takes a two-thirds vote of the council, in fact, you see it quoted there, a two-thirds vote of the council to create a binding consensus policy on the registrars, and I believe it also applies to one registry.pro, maybe. So these are contract provisions. So what was done is a new threshold was written here, because we don't have two-thirds of a council anymore. We've got a bicameral House structure, and so I'll read this. F, approve a PDP recommendation imposing new obligations on certain contracting parties where an ICANN contract provision specifies that, quote, a two-thirds vote of the council, end quote, demonstrates the presence of a consensus. The GNSO supermajority vote threshold will have to be met or exceeded with respect to any contracting party affected by such contract provision.
I believe that's a radical change from what exists now. We're going to need to get legal counsel. This is Aubrey. We're going to need to get legal counsel to give a ruling on what is the current existing policy versus what is the one that's being redefined here.
I'm not following. This is Ken. This was approved by legal department. And what they've said is that the GNSO supermajority threshold, which is three-quarters of one house and a majority in the other, is defined to be equivalent to the language in contract provisions that say two-thirds majority of the council.
Right, so I think Aubrey's right in the sense that I think legal counsel needs to be available because they are not only changing the interpretation of a, at least as Aubrey feels, a policy, but they're changing an interpretation of a contract.
It's Alan Krieger. How you doing?
So, Alan, and who else wants to get in the queue? Okay, Alan.
we talked about this an awful lot on the RAA discussion, and without having gone back to read the words, my impression, the impression was left, was that there is a two-thirds words in the RAA associated with changing the overall RAA, but that the interpretation was, although it's not clear the wording says, that if there are things within the picket fence on the RAA, that follows the standard GNSO consensus policy rules, whatever they may be. And yes, I would like to hear a legal opinion on whether there are two kinds of rules, or we're now reverting to a separate one for registrars than for registries. So I think this is going to need some discussion and understanding before we just rubber stamp it.
I think that's... this is Jeff. So Avery, I mean, I think perhaps you might want to make a request to, for the restructuring committee call. You probably want to make a request to ICANN Council to be there. This is a difficult area. You know, speaking as just a registry, because there is no provision in the registry agreements that define an exact number. But that said, as a registry, I would never agree to the premise that Avery said, which is that a successful GNSO council vote is if it's a majority of the council votes in favor of it and it goes to the board and the board approves it, that is binding consensus policy, because that was not the intent of the consensus policy language in the contracts, at least, which was to get a consensus of the Internet community, not a majority of the council / the board. That was never... When we negotiated those contracts, we would have never agreed to something like that. And we don't agree to a change in that contract.
Yet those have been the bylaws ever since God knows when.
No. Bylaws require a supermajority for the consensus policy process.
Not so.
In other words, it can go to the board. There's nothing preventing something from going to the board, right? But the board, even if it voted unanimously in favor of a policy that had a majority support of the council but not supermajority, the registries would never follow that policy unless they voluntarily wanted to. But the registries wouldn't follow that policy because we would say that's not a consensus policy process. Yes, the majority liked it and the board liked it, but that's not a consensus
And that's the one, this is Avery again, and that's the one that I think we have to speak to the legal counsel about, because just as you're sure that that is the case, I'm sure that it's not. So we obviously need someone to determine that, because that's obviously a critically important point.
I agree with you, Avery, but we absolutely need to talk to them. But as a registry, speaking solely as legal counsel for my own registry, I would say that it's irrelevant to me what legal counsel for ICANN thinks.
Okay, yeah. This may be something where the contract is sufficiently ambiguous that it's a lovely court case and we can get rich off it. But
if
it was a lawyer, me as an expert witness, we had a great time.
Your points are all noted, and I do agree that legal counsel. And again, it's one of the reasons I made a comment. For the rest of the group's sake, I made a comment saying that 20 days to comment on this was just incredibly way too short, that there are broad implications in some of these provisions, and that I feel like we're just trying to... First of all, there's been no comment period. Well, I can't say no, but in the last 6 months I went through, there's been no comment period in the last 6 months that have been less than 30 days, and we're talking some of them for real trivial matters. Here we're talking about bylaw changes, and we're only awarding 20 days to comment. And it's so fundamental to the structure of ICANN and its accountability, it just doesn't make sense to me. And we're doing it so that we can have enough time for the board, I guess, to approve it in September so that it could be in place by October, the Seoul meeting. And I think the board can call a special meeting if it needs to in early October or do other things. I don't think we need to accommodate the board for expediency's sake to try to rush this in by Seoul. I think we need to afford the appropriate comment periods or time to comment. That's my own opinion. But Ken, was there anything else on? Or I'm sorry, is there anyone else that's got comments on any of that?
Jeff, it's Paul.
Sure, Paul.
Question for Ken: when you first laid this out, you were talking about a potential alternate path here, an option of approval in principle, you know, whereby they would say, look, we think these are the right rules, but we're going to defer etching them in stone so that there's more opportunity. Is there any sort of, if you will, formal process around that? How do we ask the board at a minimum to take that approach so that everything that we're discussing right now, the need for more time, is fully understood by the board and hopefully granted?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can say more. This is Ken. More about that. I just remember that during some of the discussions we had with legal around this particular this clause F and some other things that if we didn't get complete resolution for even on F, maybe F could be carved out some way and the rest of the bylaws could go forward. And then I guess there's a number of different alternatives. One might be approving them in principle so the council can continue to act and we can go forward in Seoul. Another might be to carve out something that in fact can't be resolved and just leave it out and deal with it later. The question is going to be, I guess the determination of which of those paths will be taken has to do, I think, with what issue it is that's being carved out and whether it, in fact, would stop the council or inhibit the council from being able to act in a bicameral approach or using that bicameral apparatus for voting. So, you know, this F could turn out to be significant or not, depending on how the community dialogue goes on it. I'm not sure if I didn't give you a crisp answer there. I think there's a number of different possibilities here, and there's certainly nothing wrong with asking the board to consider something that wouldn't necessarily etch these in stone.
Okay, and I guess then just the follow-up is for our group here. I mean, Avery, is that something you take the lead on as chair of the council? Is it something that we do individually?
Yeah, for me to do anything as the chair of the council, I would need to get the council to decide that this was something they wanted to do, which is something certainly that I can, you know, put on the agenda for the next meeting.
In the interest of time, though, should we plan to do things individually then? Because when's the next council meeting? It's close to the deadline, isn't it?
The next council meeting is next week.
But there is a restructuring group meeting that hopefully will be scheduled
right. Next
week. I'm assuming those meetings are open, pretty much.
At this point, I would assume so. They you know.
They have been anyway.
Right.
And
yeah,
so
yeah.
I think you could make a request to legal counsel to be there at the restructuring.
Oh, I certainly no. Requesting legal counsel to be available for the discussions is not a problem. I can do that. What I was saying that I couldn't do, and by the way, this is Aubrey speaking, what I was saying I couldn't do was on my own make the request for delays or make the request for in principle decisions, just speaking personally, would trouble me because that means in principle we've agreed, but we're leaving it up to legal staff and others to, you know, put it in when they get it right or something. And so that leaves a space that concerns me a little. But that's a personal statement. As a chair, I have no idea what the council would feel on such a proposal.
Mm-hmm. This is Ken again. I'll just sort of wrap up then. I just wanted to point out that there were two other documents. One of them is called Staff Recommended Amendments to Bylaws. And staff should be interpreted also to mean legal. And in here you'll see what has been proposed for some of the key places where there were sort of substantive changes made versus just language. And the one that we were talking about had to do with this Article 10, 3, 11, F, the voting threshold applicable to certain contract parties. So there's not much more rationale in this document than what I talked about or we talked about, and then the Annex A. And I just want to point out one more document in case you get a chance, and that has to do with.
Actually, can you? I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, I can certainly come back to it.
Yeah.
There's another document called Notes and Comments for each amended article and section. And you'll see here that there's a mapping for every article, so we can look at Article 10, Section 2, for example. The the legend up here. That means GNSO Council drafting team language, except for changing, if any, to where applicable, removing and or names, which was not approved by the SIC, and three, remove the GNSO Council two houses because those organizations do not have charters. So in every case, we attempted to show paragraph by paragraph whether the GNSO drafting team's language was used, and if not, which was changed. And so this document may be helpful to you if you want to quickly go through and see where the material, how it varied from one issue to the next. I'm sorry. And Jeff, did you want me to go back to a different one?
Yeah, just a minor comment, but I mean, for people who are outsiders that read it, on the staff document describing the changes where it says Annex A PDP procedures, like I said, this is pretty minor, but it's not the GNSO restructuring work team that's considering, that's undergoing an extensive evaluation. It's the policy process steering committee that is undergoing that.
You mean right here?
Annex A, page 3.
Yeah,
right there. It says staff, the first paragraph, staff recognizes the GNSO restructuring work team. It's actually the policy process steering committee.
Yeah, okay.
If you want it to be more explicit, it's the policy development process work team of that.
Right. That's right. Yeah, the term GNSO restructuring work team was generic, and it encompassed the your team, the working group team, all of them, in fact. I think the intention here wasn't to be narrow and specific, but just to sort of connote that there are two work teams working on these things. And there's no misunderstanding, at least on the staff, or that it's the PDP team that's working on Annex A.
Okay. Anybody else with questions on that?
The last thing, this is Ken, I wanted to talk about was just quickly on the process, all right? So there are really only a few steps left. Assuming that the public comment form isn't extended, it will end on the 24th of August. Staff would have a day or two, and of course we're supposed to normally have all of our board papers and recommendations in 2 weeks before board meetings, but in this case it's going to have to be just a day or two. So on the 25th, 26th, staff will take all the public comments, summarize, analyze them, and write up a sort of position paper there. And then the idea was to get board approval on the 27th. It's very, very ambitious. So I just wanted to wrap that up as to what the next steps were.
Barbara, can I add something?
Yes.
This is just to endorse, or to answer the question of that Paul put forward. I think, yes. While anything else is going on, we should all be sending in as detailed, issues, discussions to the comments as we can. So at least, all of it is there for it to be paid attention to. Otherwise, it's lost.
This is Marika. Can I add something?
Sure.
Yeah, no, just to add, of course, this working team could decide as well if they see any issues that they feel as the working team they would like to comment on, even though I recognize that the deadline, of course, is very short. That might be an opportunity as well to submit something collectively.
Okay. Any other comments or questions for Ken?
It's Alan, not for Ken, but in reference to the discussion of supermajority and stuff.
Sure.
I'll send something to the list, but take a look at Section 13.F of the of Annex A, and you'll see why Avery and I think that the existing rule about 50% is there.
Sorry, so let me...
13.F. Frank.
13F? All right, I'll look at that...
A very short sentence and actually easy to parse.
What does it say?
It says, in any case in which the council is not able to reach supermajority, a majority vote of the board will be sufficient to act.
Correct. It's still an action by the council, but it doesn't...
No, by the board.
What's that?
Okay, in
the board to act.
In case the council does not reach supermajority, a majority of the board will be sufficient to act.
Yeah, but that to us, to the registries, it just means the board can take an action. Doesn't mean it's binding. Right? Nothing's preventing the board from acting.
But this
but
is
the board acts,
Section 13 is
binding.
Acting on consensus policies.
Correct. The board can act, but it does not mean that it's binding on.
I think
there's
a judge and a jury.
Okay.
I was on that task force that drafted that initial Appendix A, and the discussions that took place there was that we didn't want to say that the board couldn't take an action or that the board was hamstrung, but it was that was not saying the same thing as that was binding on the registries. Right. So, anyway,
okay.
History.
or future.
Right. And good thing this PDP group is not addressing thresholds, those thresholds. Anyway, so is there any other questions on these new developments for Ken? I see Ken's turned to Section 13. Is there? Or someone's put on. James has got a comment as well.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks. It's James. And I'm just still a little behind on this, so I'm trying to take this all in. But is it correct? Is it a correct synopsis to say that we have two questions at hand? One is the mapping of the two-thirds majority into the new structure, and then the second question being if it fails to meet that and the board, whether that then becomes a voluntary or binding policy. I'm trying to understand here if there's actually multiple issues tangled together here.
It's Alan. I think we only have one. The mapping of supermajority to the new bicameral rules has been pretty well accepted, I think.
Well, I think there's actually, I think to be, there, or there are, the,
right,
there are two issues in the sense of that the registrar accreditation agreements do have a two-thirds number in there.
Yes.
And
right.
So it's trying to figure out how the new structure will map to, or how you accommodate when one document, a contract, says two-thirds, and how that's interpreted when you have a completely different council structure and the number two-thirds just won't necessarily work for that.
But the other component of that, what you're discussing with the council and the board majority threshold, is really something that exists in the structure today.
The other issue is a difference of interpretation, I guess, between what does exist today in the sense of that in the registry agreements it says consensus policy process follows the process set forth in the bylaws. And the bylaws Annex A specifies that if there's a supermajority vote, then the board needs a certain threshold to overturn that. But it says that if there's not a supermajority vote, it needs a majority vote to, quote, act. And I guess there's a difference of interpretation of what the word act means from what I'm saying versus what Alan and Avery are saying.
Okay, but that interpretation is in, and this is James again, that interpretation exists in the language today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's really not what I want to say here, that's really not necessarily a byproduct of the restructuring.
Avery, can I comment?
Sure.
And Alan.
I think one has to be careful that we can certainly agree that perhaps the current language is ambiguous, but we need to make sure that the new language doesn't disambiguate that in a way that makes the case one way or another. If it is ambiguous, then it must remain ambiguous. If it's not, then we have to go through a fair amount of work to see which way we disambiguate it.
Well, I would amend that, saying if it's ambiguous, then we as a policy process PDP work team should make it clear, but we, the community, in the whole sense, could take something on to make it clear
in the,
through some separate process.
Jeff, in the long term, yes, but in this pass,
correct,
where we're trying to make it work for Seoul, I don't think we want to tackle the disambiguation of it.
Yeah, I think it may have to be in some sense, because if you're changing. Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah, but either way, I think legal counsel needs to be brought in to explain why they are making this recommendation to the new bylaws.
They may have opened Pandora's box, and we can't close it at this point.
Right.
Okay. a comment to Ken. We had the discussion earlier on the issue of constituency or stakeholder group, in regard to one particular section. As I was flipping through the Annex A, the same distinction has to be made in one or two other sections, so it should be made high enough up that it applies to all of them.
Yeah, like I said, when we first started with this, the language was extremely arduous, and you know, as Aubrey points out, maybe it's a byproduct of the decisions we've made, but we were trying to just simplify it a bit and not make it so so clumsy and clunky to read. But if that makes it imprecise, then we may have to go back to the way it was.
And similarly, I think you're going to find some comments on the nominating committee one where you tried to make it simple but have given the existing constituencies a significant benefit over any emerging new ones, and it's not clear the community will accept that.
There's another, this is Ken, on Article 7, Section 2, there's another proposal being working through the SIC now that we just literally sent yesterday or today. It's going to go out today. That looks at a different way of, in other words, what we were trying to do long term is to assign all of the nominating committee slots to the stakeholder group, not to constituencies, and for precisely the reason that you just articulated. Unfortunately, you have this the same sort of thing, short-term, long-term. Immediately in the bylaws, we just wanted to just fix the language and leave everything else alone while a process gets worked through to determine if we want to actually change it to be a stakeholder group function and not a constituency.
I would suggest then that needs to be addressed somewhere, because someone looking at forming a new stakeholder group would look at this, and again, one of these issues of why should I bother?
Yes, and what we were thinking is that we would put a public comment out. As soon as those discussions are held, we would add something to the public comment that says, here's something new to chew on. There's so many things to do, we haven't been able to get them all done at the same time.
If I interpret that, so what you're saying is instead of saying that the registry constituency would get one and the registrar constituency would get one, you would basically say the stakeholder group... No, I'm sorry, never mind. You would say...
Yeah, that is what they're saying now.
Well, actually, put aside... But I'm trying to assess the long term. So the long term, you would say the commercial stakeholder group would get four... Instead of saying that the business constituency within would get two or something like that?
The language reads something like the four seats or delegates would come from the commercial stakeholder group. And then underneath, representing, you know, business users, intellectual property interests, not that one from each is necessary, but that the nominating committee is asking the stakeholder group to please make sure these concepts are included in those representatives.
Since the whole, this is not our domain, but since the whole rationale for rejecting some of the stakeholder group charters and changing them was to make it attractive to new constituencies, this is sort of a slap in the face the way it's worded right now and even what you're proposing. So someone needs to think about it.
It just wasn't on the front burner until we got all the other things done, and it's now up at least on getting on a burner.
Okay, is there any other questions for Ken on the or for anyone on the or comments on the restructure? I'm sorry, on the new bylaws, proposed bylaws. Okay, then with that said, I think we can actually move on to the next item, which is, and I don't know who's got control of the. Adobe. Who's got the? Does anyone have the latest stage 2 document?
Yep, I'll pull it up.
Great. So I will also note that there is a draft that I've seen, which I'm going through now of the stage 1 and where we've come out on it. I'm just going through it now, just going checking with my notes and stuff, and that will come out within the next week. So that we can all comment on the stage 1 stuff. Right now, stage 2 for Aubrey and for others who may not have been on the last call is we're talking about the items we're talking about in this group are really proposal review and voting thresholds. Not that we're changing any voting thresholds, but providing other definition around some of the things that are indicated. I think what's in red now up on the screen are the things that we discussed on the last call, if I'm reading that correctly. So this has been up on the wiki for a few days now to review. I think what I want to do is go to the first question that we haven't addressed yet, which I think is question, I want to say 3. We've done some of these, like we've done 4. We did it kind of out of order, it just happened to come up, and I think we've also done some of 5 or some other ones, but we haven't tackled this one, and it kind of relates to something that Avery was talking about earlier or asked a question about, and actually what was taken out of the bylaws. Here it says, should the approved voting threshold apply to the entire GNSO Council or just the members present? So the voting thresholds now, the new proposed ones, just say if there's a majority, for example, if there's a majority of one house or a majority of each house, but it doesn't say that it has to be a majority of those present. I think the discussion that we had is there is an absentee voting or absentee ballot process that I guess will be incorporated in the operating rules now is the recommendation. So the question is, do we need to address this at all, or is this implicit in the rules of absentee voting?
This is Avery. Can I comment?
Sure.
I think that since it is specifically directed to PDP and elections, I think that it does supersede the rule that says of those present, because it is of all council, that you have to have a quorum to start the vote. It's certainly the rules under which I've been behaving, is that I can't call a vote unless there's a quorum, but if it's a PDP or an election, everyone that wants to vote can. So because there's no, the reason for the quorum is that there's no guarantee that anyone will actually do an absentee ballot. They are given 2 days on the average, or as little as 1 or as little as 7, depending upon situation. But there's nothing that forces them to actually submit a vote.
Well, so that presumes a couple things. It presumes, so let's say the rule is, that there's, I should probably point to a specific example, but in the bylaws it states, for example, you know, one of the thresholds are, I'm going to just turn to 1, that something requires a majority of each house, right? If something requires a majority of each house, does that mean that the house has to then have a formal meeting in which a vote is taken, or can the, or is it sufficient for, by absentee or by other means, that a majority of the council reps from that house indicate their affirmative vote? Because you're presuming, Aubrey, there has to be a, quote, meeting of the house.
No. This is Aubrey again. What was said in most of the discussions on the houses is that the house, except in the matter of electing a vice chair, is a analytical structure that exists for counting votes, but that it doesn't have any existence and meetings and bylaws and charters of its own, that it is a counting method. Except in the issue of electing a vice chair.
Getting rid of a non-common appointee.
Oh, okay, that's right. So yes, it is acquiring.
That
so
was Alan.
Probably within a couple years, yeah, it'll have a full charter and set of bylaws. But certainly the principle that it was being done under is that houses are purely for counting.
Okay, so let me just try to take it through a practical example. So you now have a council meeting, and let's say you're the chair of the new bicameral council. They
only
meet
for a week at the most.
They meet, and now you need to decide, the council needs to decide whether to approve a, or to raise an issue. Well, I'm trying to think of one that requires 50% of each house, or let's pretend approve a PDP, and let's say it requires a majority of each house. I'm just making this up. You would basically, what if an entire house doesn't show up?
Then you don't have quorum.
Then I don't have quorum. Quorum means And as in that situation, the way reading the rules as I do now, obviously,
right.
You know, I could get corrected from having misunderstood them. But the way I read the rules now, I would check to see if there was a quorum, a majority of each house present before initiating the vote. But the vote would stay open for the extra 2 days to give those who are absent a chance to vote.
Yeah, quorum ensures that there's a reasonable number of people there to discuss.
Right.
Well, it also assumes that there's a reasonable number of people there to close the vote if no one votes absentee. And as it has to be a defined, complete process. Once a vote is open, it has to have a definite termination rule.
Right, but there is an absentee vote allowed.
Right. So that just extends it. But the fact that there was quorum means that there was enough people there to also close the vote successfully.
Okay, so are you saying that you don't think we need to address it because it's implicitly addressed because of the fact that, A, you have to have quorum, and B, if there is a quorum and there is a vote taken, there is a few days allowed for absentee voting anyway, so you don't need to say the words present, you just need to say of those
voting.
Voting.
Do council rules allow for quorum to continue if people leave?
Yes.
Or it's an ongoing thing?
Established at the beginning of the meeting.
Okay.
Okay.
You can't take attendance every time you're going to do something.
So just again to summarize then, we don't really, as a PDP work team, we probably don't need to address this. I want to make sure that at least the people on this call, that they feel comfortable with that notion. Does anyone not feel comfortable with that notion? Okay, I think we can then move on to, we've talked about four, and everyone can read the notes on that. There's actually pretty significant notes on this one. I see it goes on a few pages. Five is probably something I'd like to start on the next call because it's actually a kind of in-depth question and probably one that requires substantial thought and discussion. But everything we're talking about is a normal case scenario. But in the end, you know, do we need something different for, do we need an expedited process? And I think that's part of a probably longer term or a longer discussion. I kind of want to skip that one for now and probably go to number six, which is hopefully a shorter one. It's how to involve advice from other ACs, SOs, and obtain consistent input from the board. Marie, can you remember what this was really about?
I think this was very good. As we're talking about the proposal review and the initiation of a PDP, I interpret that as meaning should ACs or SOs or the board be invited to share their views on whether GNSO Council should initiate a PDP or not. So I think that's probably slightly linked maybe as well to the issues paper and you know, where people might voice an opinion on whether they think you know staff got it right or not. So I think that's what I thought this question was related to, but I might be wrong here, and you know would invite anyone who actually raised that point to provide their input.
Marika, it's Alan. On the issuance of an issues report, is there a standard public comment at that point?
No, currently there's not.
There's no requirement
in the bylaws.
So there's no current requirement that there even be time for other people to comment?
No.
In fact, there probably, if you follow the current bylaws, there isn't time.
Well, I think. If I remember correctly, in stage one, I think we already addressed that.
We've spoken about having a public comment period at that point in time, maybe to allow for others to either, you know, address whether there's information missing or whether there are really some, you know, correctural.
Yeah, I think we talked about a draft issues report and an opportunity for it to be revised before it's finalized.
Right. So at this stage where the issues report's already done, it's already been submitted to council, council is considering whether to initiate the formal PDP and the work group, and we're also talking at this stage, once they vote to form a working group, you know, how the charter process works and approval of the charter. So that's what stage two is. So the question is, at that point, is there a need to consider advice from other ACs or SOs? At the point where now that they've already decided to formal working group, and now we're talking about charter issues.
No, I think this is the initiation of the PDP. I didn't interpret this at the charter level. This was more the question when the council received the issues report, if at that point any ACs or SOs should be invited to say, well, you know, we would really like to see a PDP for these and these reasons, or others would say, well, we don't think it should be a PDP because, you know, either you didn't get the issue right or we don't think it, you know, there's any time or resources needed to address this issue because it is not a problem, for example. It's more that question. I don't think it's related to the charter issue because I think then we're already beyond the initiation of a PDP question.
So if you follow, it's Alan, if you follow what we were talking about, there would be an opportunity for them to comment on the draft, as it were, issues report. But since that issues report could change substantially before it's finalized, the question is there a need for them to have another period before council decides to initiate or not?
This is Marika. I guess, you know, it could be, if we go down that route and we already have the comment period, you might either say, well, we already have the comments there and that should be reflected, because normally, you know, would hope that with the new process in place, with more discussion and more information gathering, hopefully an issues report would have all the information and public comments would be limited and the changes might not be substantial. But you could also ask, the comment period on the issues report is normally related more to, you know, additional information or factual corrections, and this could be a question just on the initiation of a PDP. But it could, for example, be as well a combined effort. If you have a public comment period, you could specifically ask as well, like, well, please review the issues report and note if there's anything substantial missing or if there are any errors, and also state whether you think a PDP should be initiated or not. I mean,
so you're saying we could have done it during stage one?
You could make it, if you would require a public comment period at that stage, if you wanted to make that, you know, incorporate that in the bylaws as a requirement, you could, you know, I guess then also add that question there instead of having another public comment period or a specific request that goes out to ACs or SOs asking them to submit their opinion. But I guess, you know, either way is possible or...
If I remember correctly, that huge list of comments that Jeff rolled over were talking about at the phase after the issues report and before council votes.
No, the ones you mean related to question 5, those are all related to the charter.
Right.
That's all, I'm just scrolling up, that's related to the question, where in the process is chartering done?
Okay.
Right, which is why this question 6 could be either. The question I had is, and I noticed it for the, I just noticed it in rereading the bylaws, ACs are allowed to designate, I mean, obviously all ACs are allowed to designate a person to serve as a observer or liaison to the council.
In the old bylaws, there were only two ones were bylaw mandated, the GAC and the ALAC. The other advisory committees were not included in that list. I think the proposed bylaws are more general.
Right. So don't they have input by virtue of having someone be a liaison? They can obviously talk at a
if those liaison positions were filled, yes.
Right, if they're filled. But, I mean, I'm saying that does allow them to... The fact that they don't fill them, that's their decision, but they do have the right to do that, and they do have another input mechanism by virtue of having that liaison position.
This is Aubrey. Can I comment?
Sure.
One thing, on people like the GAC, they actually can't, even though there's an invitation to have a liaison, they can't, because one GAC member cannot speak for other GAC members. And so, therefore, while they have someone monitoring the mailing list, they really don't have a liaison. And the other thing, I would tend to think that it is a courtesy that we've sometimes remembered to do. In other words, making sure that if the liaison wasn't there or if the liaison wasn't active, to send an email to the GAC or perhaps to others saying, hey, we're doing this, comment. So I guess I would think that it would not be a bad courtesy to institutionalize something like, as part of some point of the process, an invitation is sent out with a date deadline, and you know, it's purely informative, invitational, and if they don't submit, well, fine. But I think it's a good courtesy to build into the system.
I think it should be built in at some point, but is it the right? Should it be at the forming of the issue stage as opposed to whether the GNSO should form a working group, really?
I would think at the beginning.
Right. So I think at this stage, I'm not sure. Does anyone on this call at least think at this stage where the issues report's already done, it's been presented to the council, and the council is now gearing up to vote on whether to form a working group, or alternatively afterwards, after the council votes to do a working group, whether there should be input on some sort of charter.
It's Alan. I think that the courtesy call should be between the time the issues report is received and the time council votes to initiate a PDP or whatever the wording appropriate wording is. Now, that's a 15-day period today, which we don't meet. The planned revisions have it significantly longer. I see no reason not to ask for input.
So, sorry, can you just repeat? So the planned revisions have a longer period for...
Well, currently we have a 15-day period on which council must vote on whether
right.
to initiate a PDP or not. Everyone understands that's completely unrealistic.
Right.
It usually takes months. And I see no reason not, in whatever the new process is, to add a courtesy call to the SOs, ACs, and board.
Okay. Marika, do you want to note that in the...
anyone disagrees, I'd like to hear it, but...
Seems reasonable to me, this is Aubrey.
Okay. It is getting towards the hour and a half mark, which is the end of the call. Before we end the call, I do want to talk about the next meeting. The next meeting was tentatively scheduled, was supposed to be 2 weeks from now, but the registries and registrars are actually getting together in Toronto, and so I know that a number of attendees won't be able to be present. I guess the call could still go on without the registry registrar reps, including myself, or we could just make it for 3 weeks from today rather than doing the 2 weeks from today. Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
Not to say you should make a decision, but I am available 2 weeks from today. I will not be available 3 weeks from today. I don't think my voice is that crucial, however.
And this is Marika. Just to note, if we don't have any registry and registrar reps, I'm not really sure. It might be Alan, me, and Avery talking.
Not a good idea.
Well, the other thing I was thinking about to allow 3 weeks is, you know, in a few days, we'll make sure, and part of this is on me, that the draft for the, or all of it's on me, that the draft is out for stage one, because ICANN staff has actually done a version, and I just wanted to look it over before it went out just to make sure it's the same as what I have in my notes. So that should go out pretty soon, and that would give extra time for people to comment on that,
and
that draft.
Okay, well, yeah, if that's the sole content of that meeting and the draft goes out soon, then that's fine with me. Gives me an opportunity to do it ahead of time.
Right.
If there's anything else that will be discussed, I'd like significant notice. I'll be unavailable that whole week.
So what I'd like to do to make up for lost time, too, is then to do one the 27th and then again on the 3rd. And actually, we're not getting too far away from Seoul. So then,
I think there is a council call on the 3rd. I don't recall,
yes.
Aubrey, do you know by heart or Glenn at what time
yes.
it is?
At 20 UTC.
Okay, so it wouldn't conflict.
So it wouldn't conflict. Let's tentatively plan then for the 27th and then the 3rd. And on the 27th, we'll talk about whether to do the, you know, just every week, or from the 3rd, then go to the 17th and do it 2 weeks at that point. Because we are getting closer and closer to Seoul, actually, believe it or not. Anybody else have any thoughts or any last comments? All right, well, I thank everyone for coming. And, Aubrey, I'll send you a revised attendance list, including today's. And
Okay, and if you want me to pass that on to the council, indicate that in the notes so I can just then forward it on.
Yeah, I will, because I haven't gotten any response from the chair.
Okay, sure. But just, you know, give me the permission to forward it on in the notes. So.
Okay, I will do so. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks.